get right to it. Okay. The session is Radical Curricular Change Part 2. I'm always told that sequels are less popular than first edition. It's a continuation of a discussion that we had last year. I don't actually see any, I don't know if anybody was there. I don't see familiar faces, though not necessarily I would remember, so maybe I should do part one, and that way I wouldn't have to prepare. But the discussion was such that there was a lot left unsaid, and I encourage people, I'll summarize briefly what was said, and then go on to what still needed to be said. Anybody who wants to get filled in completely, there's on the YCT on the Chovei Torah website, you can find out what was discussed the first time around last year. Essentially, what we talked about was the fact that our curriculum today, not just curriculum, methodology, the whole way we organize our schools, and I'm focusing primarily on middle and high schools and up, yeshivot, seminaries, is a carryover from the yeshiva system in Europe. I mean, it's really a hybrid, the yeshiva model of Lithuania primarily, and the public / private school type of approach to education in the United States and Western Europe, Western approach towards public education. So you have a hybrid model where in the Jewish studies curriculum is Gemara-centric. It's highly centered around the study of Gemara, the study of Talmud, on a iyun type of approach. Iyun as opposed to bikiyut means that you try to plumb the depths of the text that you're learning with textual analysis, serious textual analysis, as was done in Europe in the finest yeshivot, with Slobodka and Mir, in a whole slew of yeshivot that existed over there. I made the claim at that time, and I think it's true, that we've never analyzed whether this model fits the needs of contemporary Jewish society, be it in Israel, be it in the United States, in the diaspora in general. The question has not been raised seriously to see whether our goals are going to be met by this type of system, this type of approach. And again, the session, just reviewing part one from last year, that the contention that I made is that it does not, in fact, fit the needs of contemporary society. And I made reference to a famous article, which if you have not read, or if you haven't read it recently, you should reread, or read for the first time, from Chaim Soloveitchik, called Rupture and Reconstruction. I don't know how many people have read that, but if you haven't, you should absolutely read it. It speaks about transformation of Orthodox society in the last 50 years. And he makes many interesting claims, one of which is that the faith that was assumed, and he's not the only one who says this, by the way, many people are saying this, the faith that was assumed in, let's say, pre-World War II, Jewish society, which was simply imbibed from the culture, simply part of the air that a person would breathe. And certainly, if it's not the case 60 years ago, it's certainly the case 200, 150 years ago, or at least in Eastern Europe, in North Africa, and anywhere except for the most advanced countries, that type of internalization of faith no longer exists. And it's something that has to be somehow substituted, somehow dealt with in another fashion. He speaks about the schools, he speaks about book learning, and he's speaking as a historian sociologist. He's not making any type of recommendations. He's simply saying that this is what's happened. It used to be that faith was passed on in the family and in the community, and now we don't really have this direct access, and we're sort of circumventing it by the use of book learning. That was the claim that was made. And based on that, I suggested that we need a curriculum that's not faith-assuming, as the yeshivot's curriculum were, because it could be assumed that even though there were issues in yeshivot and there was a lot of discussion about all sorts of isms that were around in the general population, the culture at large, nonetheless, by and large, the students that came in at least were part of this community that could be faith-assuming. And as we assume that they believed in the major tenets of Judaism, understood on some level the Jewish Welt, the Torah Welt Anschauung, that is highly questionable today. And so I made the claim that instead of a curriculum that's faith-assuming, we need a curriculum that's faith-building. And that Gemara Be'iyun, as the center of that curriculum, simply doesn't fit the bill. What I want to do today is discuss exactly my vision of what a new curriculum that would answer our needs would look like. Simply my suggestion. I don't think it's that critical what I have to say. I think more important is that we simply put the question on the table, that we re-examine our curriculum in a complete sort of way. No holds barred, that we start from the beginning, decide without any sort of assumptions that Gemara has to be there, for example, if I were to have my way. Or anything else for that matter. Everything should be judged according to the need that it meets. I think that generally when you build a curriculum, intelligently, you start with certain educational, social, whatever types of needs that exist, right? It's not only educational. In the United States also, if you read John Dewey and more recently people are speaking about teaching towards democracy. Right? So it's not necessarily an educational goal. There's a social goal or a political goal, if you will. We have, besides educational goals, I think more importantly, we have religious goals as well as social goals on some level, political goals. And these are how we should be evaluating any curriculum that we propose. I'll give out a syllabus that I used recently. Let me pass this back. They're the same. Yeah, the same thing. That I used in a class that we had recently at the David Cardozo Academy, which is a co-sponsor of the Yom Eiyun, and it's where I teach. I'm the education director there. Our students, just to give you the context of this, is not the ideal reading list. It's written for students who would come to classes once a week, intelligent students, graduate students, SMIFA students, but people who have a lot of other readings to do. This is just a basic beginning reading list and some of the things that I'm proposing. So I'm going to group the first three items on the list. Now, we'll use this just as sort of aid in terms of guiding what I envision as a curriculum that, in fact, would be faith-building as opposed to faith-assuming. When I speak about faith, I'm only not speaking only about belief in God or belief in Torah and Shemayim, as we just discussed before dinner, but also tenets of relevance, which Howard Gardner, famous educator, today describes as transmitting our view of ethics, beauty, and truth. Right? Ethics, beauty, and truth. What do we consider ethical? What do we consider beautiful or inspiring, if you will? And what do we consider true? Again, it's spoken about multiple narratives, but what is the Jewish view of truth? Another interesting discussion of truth in the educational context, actually Parker Palmer speaks about what truth means to Western culture. He speaks about Christian culture, really, as a value. So these are things that we have to transmit to acculturate our children to Judaism, as well as to inspire them and excite them to want to be involved in a tradition which is competing with others. We live in an open society where on some level or another, maybe even, you know, wherever you are, on some level our children are going to choose their Judaism. what type of Judaism and whether Judaism altogether. So there has to be a curriculum within our schools that's going to promote a vision of Judaism that's going to be positive enough and meaningful enough for them to want to choose that Judaism which we so much hold dear. In any case, as I said, this is the beginning of a discussion, and I'm just going to go through my own thoughts based on this curriculum that I gave over. About curriculum as a mini course really given at our academy. The first three, I'm going to focus on some things on this list more than others simply out of lack of time. As it was very much what we call Roshei Prakim, just the highlights of what needs to be discussed. And here we're going to discuss the highlights of the highlights. But that's the time frame, and that's all we can do for tonight. The first three issues is the first three items, rather, on the list is what text are we going to use? Again, the use of Gemara in terms of teaching us what's true, what's beautiful, what's ethical is very limited, especially if we're studying Gemara as it's studied today in microcosmic level. In other words, within a typical Gemara class, one studies only a few pages over the course of a semester. Usually very technical issues, usually very technical, very dry. The process itself with a good teacher is very interesting. As I've said before, the comparison to algebra or physics. A good teacher can make algebra or physics very exciting. A good teacher can make Gemara very exciting as well. But as I would imagine, not being a physics teacher and algebra teacher, that one sees very little of the three items that we've spoken about, of truth, of ethics, of beauty, in algebra or physics, though there's certainly some beauty there, certainly there's some truth there, but compared to other things, compared to literature, compared to religion, compared to discussions of philosophy, there's much less there. So if I were to try to transmit, if I was a secular individual creating a secular Western curriculum, and my main goal was simply to transmit these things, I wouldn't put algebra at the top of my curriculum. I would put other things. I would suggest the same thing would be true of Gemara as well. That's not to say Gemara has no place. Exactly what place it should have is the subject of another discussion, but its central place in the curriculum is simply not justified. So, in the first three, we speak about using texts. And the first two, we'll get to the soul of the Gemara in a minute, but the first two are really the texts that I would suggest be our major foundational texts. Because I think there's an importance in using original texts. And I speak of foundational texts as opposed to later writings, in other words, writings that have been enshrined, that have been canonized on some level, Tanakh, Midrash, Agadata, which you'll find in the Gemara as well. I'm staying away from Machshava, even though Machshava has a place in this curriculum as well. And a very important text which deserves to be studied in great detail, we'll get back to a little bit later, and that's the Sidur. Right? Sidur, which is the greatest irony is that is the text with which we have the most contact of any, just about anyone, unless you're involved in Talmudic study full time. Anybody else, the most contact we have on a daily, certainly on a weekly basis, is with the Sidur. And paradoxically, it's a text we understand and study the least. It's a very strange thing. And lest one think that it's just an easy, obvious text and the words are so simple and the themes and the ideas are so obvious, Rosh Shlomo Volba says what I think is truth. Someone who's very insightful and looks at it carefully says that, in fact, one of the most difficult texts in all of Torah Sheba'al Peh is the Sidur. It's one of the most difficult texts. So we have someone who's of stature who said it, so we can rely upon him. But I think, again, all you have to do is look at the Sidur and see that it's a sophisticated text. And yet, we rarely, if ever, study it, in spite of the fact that we're constantly using it. So we'll get back to that in a few minutes, but right now, focus first of all on Tanakh, Midrash, and Agadah. I'm going to focus a little more on Tanakh, even though, and basically I'm going to focus on Tanakh because it's the subject of the day, and so I think it deserves specific attention. In learning Tanakh, Tanakh's not automatically going to serve our needs either. There are many sections of Tanakh that, again, can become exciting, but are not naturally so. One has to be selective. There's no sacrilege in choosing a text and excluding other texts. It's been done from time immemorial. The yeshivot in Europe and up until today only study specific gemarot, as well known. They study Nashim and Ezekiel, and only certain tractates within Nashim and Ezekiel, and only certain chapters, and even there, which part of the chapter, right? There's jokes about this, that you end up only knowing, you know, only a few daf in all the Talmud. They did that for a reason. Again, in its place, in its time, this was strategic, and it was well thought of, because there are certain parts of text that serve your goals better than others. The idea that you have to start, I don't know where that started, that learning Bereishit means starting Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, and just going through as far as you can, with no interest in what you're studying. Everything, because it's there, you simply go through it Pasuk by Pasuk, as was mentioned before, and even it's thematic, it's Perek by Perek, you end up not using any sort of selectivity in terms of your curricular needs, which is extremely unfortunate. So I think we have to take advantage of the fact that there is so much variety within Tanakh, and that there are sections that lend themselves much more to discussion of values, to discussion of beauty, of spiritual issues that children and adults and young adults are very curious and interested in knowing about. Besides the fact that we can actually studies these sections and not realize that the themes are even there because we're not insightful enough to realize what's going on. Obviously, we have to be looking for certain things. We have to be trying to find relevance within the discussions. Again, relevance, as I've written about, is not a bad word. It's important that what we're teaching in the context of Jewish education be something that our children are going to be able to grab onto and feel this means something to them. What I said about what we teach in Tanakh is also true of what commentaries we use. Not all commentaries are equal. And again, the idea of studying Rashi just because that's what's been done is not necessarily a good idea, even though there's some tremendously insightful Rashis, tremendously interesting Rashis. But again, to go one by one, if you're having a class in the study of Rashi, an intellectual exercise in trying to understand how Rashi works, and that has its place, and I enjoy doing that myself, that's not necessarily the goal of what we're trying to get across. So if we're looking to, again, inspire and engage our students, we have to be selective. Which comments of which commentaries? I mean, certain commentaries lend themselves much more to the modern era. Rishon Sholem Fuller Hirsch, for example, is someone, again, not necessarily everything he says, but is a commentary that speaks generally to a lot of our concerns in modern society, in contemporary society. The advantages of using Tanakh as a central text are many. Number one, certainly as opposed to Midrash and Agadah, Gemara in general, the vocabulary is more limited, generally speaking. The accessibility is more, there's more familiarity with the text. The fact that we read Parsha Shavua every week in Shul makes it something that's relevant just on a very practical level, the Haftarah as well. In fact, I remember Rabbi Tzvi Grumetz, who's teaching now also, once gave a class in high school in Haftarot. I don't know how many schools do that, but there's a tremendous wisdom in doing that. Haftarah is something that we generally don't pay attention to and shul. Yet it happens year after year with the same things that we. This week wasn't so bad. I was called up, and it was actually a sefer that we're more familiar with, and we know the story better in Shmuel. But the Haftarah that we have in Yeshayahu and Yeheskel, all these things, the vocabulary is difficult, and when we come to shul, we simply schmooze with our neighbor, and in the worst case and the best case, fall asleep. It's something that we don't really know how to relate to. The fact that it's there and it's going to be done, whether we like it or not, is a good reason to choose these texts as something that our students need for their adult lives. The fact that Tanakh on some level is more connected to the divine, is the Word of God, how God expresses Himself through prophecy, is something that is, again, something very important in terms of the centrality of the text, right? It's the some people think that Tanakh is a commentary on the Gemara. In fact, we know that it's sort of backwards. The flexibility in study of Tanakh is to our advantage in a society such as ours, which stresses autonomy. I mean, the big problem we have in our classrooms is our students who believe, who feel from the rest of their experience that they should be able to interpret a text for themselves have problems when it comes to halakha, because there is a bottom line, and if they disagree with the bottom line, it doesn't really matter. The bottom line stays the bottom line. Granted, that's true in American law also, but rarely do we have this engagement in secular classrooms with American law. It's not a holy text. It's not really something that's meant to be so relevant to children's lives. The Gemara is supposed to be this tremendously relevant text. So what happens when they disagree with the conclusions of this relevant text that they're supposed to love? It's difficult. It's a problem that has to be addressed in a separate forum. But one of the advantages of Tanakh is that it's really open-ended. And we know that even the Mefarshim will understand simple level or different levels of Tanakh in opposition to halakha. As I say, the halakha is an interpretation of the text, but there are other interpretations. Again, this is part of our tradition, that even Rashi will bring texts that will bring interpretations of the text that actually go against the halakha, simply because he's trying to address the pshat level, address the simple level of the text. Again, the greatest advantage of Tanakh, which is also true of the other texts that I'm recommending as major texts, is that it addresses macro themes, right? Issues of inner conflict, of ethics, of devotion, providence. All these issues are things that concern most of us, concern most people. And you don't have to be Jewish. These are issues that are life issues, and most people, even children, are interested in life issues. So as opposed to someone was talking about the ox that gores the cow, which is a very little interest to most people, to discuss the sibling rivalries that occur in, say, for Bereishit as an example, or the issue of self-sacrifice, the issue of confusion, all sorts of issues that crop up time and time again in various stories in the Tanakh, is to our advantage. A lot of what I've said about Tanakh is true of Agadah and Midrash as well. Certainly the biggest drawing point for this thing is here also you're dealing with meta-themes, you're dealing with larger issues, you're dealing with issues that speak about spirituality more directly than halakha. The Midrash and Agadah has a disadvantage in that it's more difficult for us to teach, in the sense that none of us have much training, if any, in Agadah. Tanakh has sort of survived in our schools as the sort of handmaiden of Talmud, of Gemara. We had Nechama Leibowitz as a teacher in the previous generation. People have studied Tanakh, and there's a renewed interest in Tanakh, so that at least we have a foothold there, and it's easy to expand from a sense of some comfort. When it comes to Midrash and Agadah, we have very little to go on. We don't have background. We simply have not been taught Midrash and Agadah. Heschel was mentioned before dinner, someone who was involved in Agadah. There have been some people. But again, the problem is that we're not coming with that in our portfolio. And on some level, what ends up happening, in much of what I'm suggesting, and I don't think that we need to shelve it for that reason, but we're talking about crippled teaching people to walk. We're crippled in these departments. We simply don't know what we're doing. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that that's the answer. The answer is, since we don't know, we'll simply not try it at all. I think it has to be tried. I think that's right.
Where the teacher becomes the mentor.
Absolutely.
And the students are colleagues.
That's right. That's exactly an approach that has to be used. Again, for obvious reasons, a lot of teachers are insecure in that area or with that approach. But it certainly has to be tried. There are, by the way, other issues that come up. We said we don't know how to teach it. In studying Agadah, where there's not a clear conclusion, as there is in halachic areas of the Talmud, are we looking for some sort of conclusion? Are we looking for a trend? And there's a general consensus. How wide is the consensus and exploring the contours? Are we dafka looking for diversity, for the possibility of opinions that are out there? So what to stress is perhaps something that needs to be left up to the individual teacher. But it's something, as I said, that nonetheless we have to do. Another complaint that people have about teaching of Agadah is that there are no commentaries. And it's true, there's a much larger literature of commentaries on halachic sections of the Talmud, which makes it, again, every teacher loves to have textbooks that they don't have to write themselves. Right? And if you have Rishonim, if you have commentaries, they do all the work for you. All you have to do is see what they said. You don't have to say anything yourself. Truth is, in Agadah, there are texts out there. Again, part of the reasons we're not familiar with the text is because it's been discouraged, and again, the Lithuanian school that we're sort of carried over and imported into our own school. Agadah that wasn't studied, and therefore we're not even familiar with commentaries are out there. The Ben Ish Chai, by the way, was Sfardi Posek in Baghdad, is perhaps the richest source of commentary on the Agadah. Besides him, obviously, there's the Maharal, there's the Sefer called the Ein Yaakov, which is a series of commentaries on all essentially all the Agadot of the Talmud, and the halachic sections are cut out. Right, and the Ein Yaakov himself was in Turkey, I think, 1500s, 1600s. He had his commentary, which is only one of the many commentaries that have been placed in the standard editions. Rav Kook himself wrote commentaries both on Masechet Shabbat and Masechet Brachot, again, only on the Agadot, which can be difficult, as Rav Kook can always be. And the Maharal is also someone who speaks at great length on the. He has a series of books called the Chidush Agadot. All these are tools that we can use. And again, if we're going to take it seriously, then these are books that we should become more familiar with. People have said things and have interpreted the Agadot with great skill. And the same way as we look at what our scholars have said about halacha, we should look at these books as well. Excuse me? He's written, I wasn't aware. Okay. Okay. I'm not familiar with the work, but I'm sure that would be a good thing. On the sheet, on the curriculum that I taught, item number 3, the soul of Gemara, has the most sources that I assigned to my students. The soul of Gemara was really sort of a bidiyavad type of situation. I told them that ideally we shouldn't be teaching Gemara at the Iyun at all. Again, whether it should be some sort of survey course in 12th grade, give people an idea of what Gemara is, what it's about, whether gifted students or people have special interests, but by and large, for the majority of our students, they shouldn't be learning Gemara, at least halachic Gemara, as far as I'm concerned. Nonetheless, there are those that suggest that we meet the curricular goals that I'm suggesting through the study of Gemara. Rabbi Avi Wolfish, who's here at the Yom HaIyun, is one of them who wrote an article about this. Rabbi Scott Berman's another. Certainly one can try to find values within discussions of Gemara, that the mashal, the analogy that I gave in terms of trying to reach our curricular goals through the study of Gemara is essentially if you want to go from point A to point B, right, you have a super highway going from one point to the other, and you have crooked and winding side streets accomplishing the same goal. There's really no reason to take the crooked and winding side streets unless you're sightseeing, you know, on some level. Perhaps that's what we're doing by learning Gemara, but one would want to get to the goals in as effective and efficient a manner as possible. There's a quote from Levinas, actually, Emmanuel Levinas, who tried to do this and suggested that the Gemara is full of deeper meaning. He says as follows. Levinas, as you know, is a French Jewish philosopher, and he, among the many things they wrote, he published Talmudic studies that he would give every year. There's a colloquium of French Jewish intellectuals that would meet, and it became a tradition that he would take a piece of Gemara and discuss it with the rest of his colleagues. Levinas is an interesting person. He was from Eastern Europe, fairly disconnected from his tradition, grew up among the French intellectuals and intelligentsia, and came back on some level to his tradition. Not exactly the same level as Rosenzweig, but he became much more involved in Jewish tradition, saw the value even in halakha, but very much a product of Western culture and Western society. But in any case, he had this very strange teacher, forgot his name, a nickname, that's not important, Shushan, if anybody has heard of this. Shushani was this teacher of Levinas, a very strange character, a very mysterious character. He was also a teacher of Elie Wiesel, if anybody is familiar with that story. But in any case, Levinas would give these Talmudic discussions at this colloquium every year in Paris. He says as follows, I'm telling you the context. He says, it is certain that when discussing the right to eat or not to eat an egg hatched on a holy day, right, this beginning of tractate Beitzah, or payments owed for damages caused by wild ox, right, as we discussed before, Shorsha Nagach et Hapar, the sages of Talmud are discussing neither an egg nor an ox, but are arguing about fundamental ideas without appearing to do so. So claims Levinas. On some level, there's something to that. But I think first of all, I'm not sure that it's correct on any significant level, and even if it is, to unearth these values as some people have tried to do, is a taxing process, is a difficult process, and I think many of our students will recognize it as an artificial process, something that's not really there. Again, can it be done? Perhaps. Should it be done? Doesn't make a lot of sense unless, and this is what I'm teaching to my students, unless we're forced to by our administrations to say that you have to learn Gemara, there's no way out. You know, I'm not going to change our curriculum because of your new ideas. And therefore, we have to accomplish what we accomplish within certain parameters. And if that's the case, then we need to learn how to find such things. By the way, Levinas himself, almost all of his discussions are actually from Agadita. So the claim that there's so much pregnant meaning in Beitza and the damages of the ox seem to be more of a rhetorical flourish than anything else. Yeah, no, it's not on purpose. History has a place, absolutely. I'm looking at texts. I'm looking at texts, and I'm looking at primary strategies. I think history has a role, as I mentioned before. Jewish thought also has a role. Jewish thought is also not on the page. I'm looking at foundational texts and direct application of.
I was horrified to find out that my students couldn't figure out, even by induction,
yeah,
whether it was the Romans or Babylonians that destroyed the first temple.
Yeah, it's tremendous ignorance. There's no question. But again, the issue of ignorance, which is an issue that people will ask us about in terms of our selection of teaching material, is dependent on what was our primary goal. Now, skills and knowledge are important, but I would argue they're important as secondary goals. You don't, but... Yeah, no, there's definitely value. Again, it's a question of hours and time and priorities. I'm looking at the priorities. I think breadth of knowledge, knowing the whole system, in as much as that's possible, is an important thing. But only once we've assured that our primary goal of religious acculturation is accomplished. That's again, there's limited time and limited energy. I think there's room. But the imbalance has to be corrected with a radical shift so that we know what our priorities are and what they're not. I think skills, by the way, and breadth of knowledge can be accomplished alongside what we're doing. I think along with the text that we're doing, we can bring in skills. We can bring in what's called biki'ut, right? The breadth of knowledge and information. But we have to remember what's the primary goal and what's the secondary goal. There's actually a beautiful essay in Tivot Chinuch, which is the text we use in the first semester of the class that you have the syllabus in front of you, which was a Slonim Rebbe, who passed away only a few years ago. And he speaks about the importance in education of knowing your primary goals from your secondary goals. Doesn't mean you shouldn't have secondary goals, but you have to know what's ikar and what's tefel. And again, a lot of educators, a lot of Jewish institutions have confused the primary and the secondary. There's one school, I won't reveal the name, who understands the knowledge of Hebrew as their mission statement. That's what they want. And this is an Orthodox institution. That's the goal. The goal is that people should be fluent in Hebrew. To me, that's a travesty. Again, I think knowing Hebrew is tremendously important as a skill in order to be able to have access to greater meaning in our lives. And as identification with Jewish people, many, many important reasons to know Hebrew. And I'm not trying to belittle it. But if that's your one primary goal, I think you're completely off the mark. But let's get back to... Slonim Rebbe. I don't know. Or Shalom. I don't know what it is. The next component, and these are even more experimental than what we've spoken about before, we'll go quickly through them because we don't have a lot of time left, but we're going to speak about teaching mitzvot, spirituality on a direct level, the education of tefillah, and then motivatory approaches. So number one, mitzvah education. We, again, imitating schools in the West as well as in Eastern Europe, are teaching through books and teaching information. And, even in the best of situations where it's not only frontal learning, we're dealing essentially is with information and the absorption of information. The experiential component is something that we only use as some sort of tool to education. In science labs, you do an experiment, somehow internalize the book lesson in a better way to see it live. And when we're speaking about mitzvot and spirituality, experiential appreciation of what's going on is of essence. I mean, we speak about nase v'nishma, of the nase coming before the nishma. It seems that in our schools we have it backward. We do a lot of studying about what to do, and the doing is something that somehow is an afterthought. Again, in our schools there is some experiential education. We have the matzah factory once a year, right? Chabad in many communities provides us with and encourages various schools to make use of. We have the visit to the nursing home twice a year. We have various token activities that a school uses. I remember the Rosh Chodesh Chagiga, which was oftentimes were a disaster. We tried to get the students to dance with a band, and nobody understood what Rosh Chodesh was all about to begin with and what it had to do with music. But it was always good to have an excuse not to go to class. There is very little serious experiential learning. And as we'll talk about a little later, unfortunately, experiential learning of this type has a bad name in our schools. It's something that's for NCSY, or for informal education.
Not even in Tefillah.
Yeah.
I was leading Tefillah for some of the girls in the school, and the girls said, we're the only ones halakhically required to daven.
Yeah.
Right? And therefore, we shouldn't have to daven with the little kids.
Right.
Even though the Rosh Hashiva thought they should be davening and helping the young kids, strengthening the young kids in the davening. And then what I was, so I said, okay, and I was sort of davening separately with them, and their goal was to get through as much text as quickly as possible, no desire at all to do anything involving actually understanding. We'll get to that in a couple minutes.
In terms of experiential education, I just want to make a couple of suggestions on how to make it intelligent and acceptable. Number one, experience can be part of a sugya, part of textual learning also. It can be right in the middle. We can study about the idea, perform it, and then study it again. And a sugya includes halakha in this case, because at this point halakha is something that you're going to experience, not just to study, as well as agadah, because in fact much of our performance is not just laws, but it's in fact embellished. There's a lot of discussion as to its meaning, as to its beauty in midrashim and agadah, and further writings such as in chassidut, tamei mitzvot, etc. Following an activity, and I'll give a few examples, there should be a debriefing and discussion. It should be talking about how we felt, right? Not just, you know, how did it feel? Did it feel good? Did it feel bad? Why did it feel good? Right? Forget about what did you feel, did you blow the shofar the right way or the wrong way? That's right. We're not interested in right now. How did it feel? You know, what were your emotions? You know, did it feel exciting? Did it feel uninteresting? What was stimulated? What were your thoughts? And the emotional component has to be a very important central part of that, and as we'll discuss later, we need to create safe spaces for our students to be able to share their emotions. It's a very important thing which we lack in our schools. So I'll just give you a couple of examples, both Ben Adam Le Chavero as well as Ben Adam Le Makom. We spoke about Bikur Cholim, and that's a natural and fairly easy mitzvah to do. Thank God our parents and grandparents are living longer lives, and there are more people to visit who are not completely well. First of all, it's not a very practical level. People of that in that situation really need, you know, we talk about the mitzvah, they really need that this type of interaction. We've become a very sanitized society where young people rarely see old people, and vice versa. It's very unfortunate, especially when it's a central pillar of Gemilut Chasadim. But the token visit once or twice a year for a Hanukkah visit to sing is simply in terms of the power that mitzvah education can actually provide for our students is severely lacking. Again, I think that not only can this be done more frequently, but it can be done within the context of studying the laws. And as an example, the laws here, as in most halachot that are lived, are meant to give a certain meaning. For example, in Bikur Cholim, if you look in the halachot in Shulchan Aruch, a person ideally has to do something for the sick person. Clean the room, you know, pull up a blanket, say tefillah for the sick person. So that would be a subject of discussion, right? You go in, you say hi, and you ask them if they need anything. Why is that necessary? Why is that the definition of proper Bikur Cholim, right? But as I said, the emotional and experiential component has to be discussed as well, not just on a halachic level, but as we know, a lot of times that experience is awkward. Grant, part of the reason it's awkward is because we don't do it enough, and presumably that would go away. But it's important to bring that on the table. Say, you know, how did you feel? You know, what was it like, you know, experiencing someone who was not well, who was senile, who smelled bad, right? And explaining what's the value? Why is this a mitzvah? Why is there a mitzvah involved? Where does it come from? Does it come from solidarity? Does it come from imitating God? And there need not be any right answers. It's important for students to connect, again, experientially with the performance of mitzvot. Nichum Avelim is a similar discussion. Tzedakah, which is again something that's done in school, but not at all the potential in terms of a more holistic Jewish education that exists in tzedakah is not at all utilized in terms, again, of discussing the Rambam's levels of tzedakah, right? Why are there different levels? And how does it feel? Do you enjoy giving? What about if it was money for a trip that you were going to go to Disney World and you know, you had to give 10% of that, now you couldn't go to Disney World, or you had to work harder to raise that extra 10%. How did that feel? Were you resentful? Did it help when you got a plaque from, you know, that the orphans in Israel who you're helping out? All these are important discussions. Again, we sort of have our students do it without giving it any attention when mitzvot, if they're to be meaningful and part of a larger system that has a value to our students, needs to be put front and center. I mentioned the mitzvah there, ben adam le chavero, ben adam le makom, something like matzah baking or sitting in a sukkah. Again, you know, the experience of baking matzah quickly, what did that do for them? That make them nervous? You know, what was the sense? What does that evoke in them? What's their connection with the mitzvah? And how do they understand the speed or whatever else was involved, or sitting in the sukkah, the vulnerability, and you know, the bees that come into the sukkah. What do they think about that? How do they relate to that? How does that fit into their spiritual relationship with God? Right. So all these are things that can be used much more, and it doesn't have to be something that's Mickey Mouse. It can be something that's very sophisticated. And I think we have to stop worrying about, you know, fingers that are going to be pointed and say, you know, we're involved in rigorous Talmudic study, and here you're talking about bees and sukkah. It's backwards, because when we form a curriculum, you look at the goals that you want to reach and not necessarily what looks more sophisticated, more slick. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, perhaps that's where team teaching comes in. I think the problem is that it's not coming, it's rarely coming from the administration. If the administration has a coherent, well thought out curriculum, then one can bring different skills from different faculty members to the best advantage of the students. But if it's an individual teacher, sort of the lone ranger who's trying to do everything on their own, it's simply not going to work. They have their agenda, which is very much a personal agenda, which is not supported by the institution. It's going to be difficult to work with such a teacher, but for understandable reasons, because they're trying to do something that's really a lone effort. But again, we're talking about the ideal world. On a practical level, it's going to end up being individual levels, and there's going to be shortcomings no matter what approach you take until it becomes a unified effort. But let me just go on. I just want to finish a couple more points, and then I'll leave some time for questions. The issue of teaching spirituality straight on. Over here, I tap into a lot of what's being written outside of the Jewish world. We don't have discussions of speaking about spirituality. Again, we've spoken about is through the medium of text or through the medium of mitzvah experience. But what about speaking about God? Speaking about a person's sense of the soul? Simply speaking about it. Again, everything we've been speaking about till now and after now is going to be through some sort of medium. This discussion is an important discussion that's happening in not only in non-Jewish schools, but in public schools as well. There's tremendous movement towards this. I gave my students an article that was in Jewish Educational Leadership from a woman named Rachel Kessler, who, to the best of my knowledge, is not a religious Jew, probably is Jewish. She has a program called Pathways, which you can read about, and I think it was a couple issues back, which has been brought to at least one Jewish school. Many non-Jewish schools have been using it, which is to create some sort of safe space for students, and over time, and many, many exercise, many hours, to create some sort of safe space for discussion of questions that really concern their spirituality. Again, there's room, even in secular public schools, for spirituality, then all the more so there should be room for spirituality and discussion in Jewish schools, which purport to lead our students in that direction. I mentioned the name of Parker Palmer as probably the most important leader in this avenue. He has an organization called Courage to Teach. He's written several books as well and discusses how we go about this. There is one rabbi I know who is trying to do something in the Jewish world also, someone called Aryeh Ben David in Israel, has a program called Ayeka. I'm not a big fan, because I don't think he's doing anything that's specifically Jewish. I think he's doing something very valuable, but he's essentially bringing what's being touted by non-Jews and sort of giving it a facelift, but essentially it's the same material. So it's fine, but there's nothing specifically Jewish, at least as far as I understand it. But the point is that all these people are trying to find ways that we can bring spirituality in the classroom by counsel method, by bringing people into a safe space, by exercises of keeping silence, of knowing how to treat each other in a sensitive way, meaning students to treat each other in a sensitive way, where people can say whatever they want to say and not run the risk of being attacked or ridiculed. And there are ways to do that. Again, apparently these people have been working with all sorts of different classroom settings. Journal writing is one way, for example, when you know the activity is mediated and it's quiet, students are much more willing to extend themselves. Very quickly, tefillah education, right? There's a lot that can be said about this. We're completely not reaching the potential of what could be done with tefillah. There are all sorts of exercises that we could do, both in terms of kavanah, in terms of meditation, simply dealing with silence. What's interesting is all one has to do is even just look in the Shulchan Aruch, and the various halachot that have to do with tefillah are things that we don't do for a variety of reasons, but that promote spirituality, promote more of a sense of understanding what we're doing. For example, there's a halacha that one has to prepare for tefillah, meaning that one has to be quiet for a few seconds. We don't do that. And again, there's tremendous reason for that can enhance the spirituality of tefillah. Again, simply as a text, The same way we teach any other text, we can teach the Siddur in a much more fundamental and interesting fashion. The concepts that are involved in tefillah, such as tefillah b'tzibur, set form and times, themes such as tshuva, geula, all these things that we rarely explore that are usually quite interesting and relevant for our students, that would connect them more readily to Jewish tradition and the values that exist therein. There's room for learning by imitation, and unfortunately we're not necessarily always the best role models, though on some level we have a responsibility to try to be better role models. I've talked about tefillah field trips, and when schools go to Israel, for example, on a field trip, how many of them, you know, they go to Masada, they go to the Kotel, but how many of them go to see people who are praying properly and seriously? Be that a Hasidic shtibel, be that a Hesder yeshiva, and as people don't have to look weird to pray properly, and sometimes that's difficult, it's them, you know, if you look weird, then you can daven properly, but if you look normal, you know, if you're in a t-shirt, you can't daven, you know, with kavanah, so take them to Hesder yeshiva, where the tefillah is very serious, but the people are praying with kavanah, and the tefillot are long, something that they're not used to. Finally, motivatory approaches. And we'll leave a couple minutes for questions. Motivatory approaches, we should look at chassidut, we should look at musar. Musar doesn't always have to be a negative experience. There are many va'adei musar that are spreading across the country, not only in the Orthodox world and in other denominations as well. We don't have time to really get into that, but there are strategies that have been developed, at least in these two areas, and there are others as well, Jewish meditation, that we should use more readily and should tap into, because these are motivatory approaches that, again, are not simply a waste of time for what a teacher should do when they want a free period. I think, and I want to conclude with this, I think one of our biggest problems is the sort of stigma that exists in Jewish education, that we have to be as rigorous as what's being taught in the secular classroom. I agree that we have to be as rigorous, but the question is when and why and what context. Again, we have to be clear of what our goals are. Our goals are very different than what our goals are, or should be very different than what our goals are in the secular part of the day. Unfortunately, I hear that the goals on the secular part of the day is for our students to get to Harvard and Princeton, and the Jewish part of the day, our goal is to get them into the Gush and to Midrashet Lindenbaum. I think that's perverse. Unfortunately, and there's a vicious cycle that goes on, that the people who are willing to experiment are people that are desperate, and therefore we're getting schools and students that are problematic and that give experiential and experimental approaches to Jewish education a bad name. It's sort of a difficult situation where one doesn't know where to start, but on some level, and I think realization is spreading, that in the same way as Palmer and others speak about the tremendous void that is more and more obvious in the secular schools and the private schools, I think more and more of us are realizing that this spiritual void, which is a tremendous danger, is existing in our schools as well, and there's a sense that something has to be done. Unfortunately, the sense is, let's import a little bit of what Rabbi Nataf has to say, which I think is not going to do the trick. It's something that we have to take very seriously before the problem gets out of hand, that it's too late. And again, it's a very quiet and slow revolution that we're speaking about, but I think it's something that if we put on the agenda and enough people think about it and hear about it, that eventually it may not only be the marginal schools and students that will get the benefits of this approach. Yeah. Okay.
I just want to add that perhaps we also have to make sure that our students know the primary goal and why we're doing this.
Absolutely.
So, you know, too often we go into classes and we go to the students and say, why are you spending so much? I don't get it. If they can't really tell you the answer in terms of making them more sure there, we've done a good job.
Yeah, excellent point. Excellent point. People have to know. Okay, thank you. There's information about our school and sign up sheet if anybody wants weekly emails about this and similar topics. Please sign up.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.